Hello and welcome to episode number 17 of our Research VR podcast, where we dig deep into virtual reality with cognitive science and economic research. For those of you joining us for the first time, Research VR is a weekly podcast dedicated to breaking down years of virtual reality research into a digestible form and discussing the current economic trends of the industry around the world. I'm your host, Peter Lekhoff from Salt and Pepper, and today I'm joined by my regular co-host, Christoph Izdebski.
Hello.
So today on the show, we are having also with us Julie Kroner, a social scientist and
ethnographic
researcher, with whom we are discussing the shift from information to experience age, with a specific focus on the influence of VR. Hello.
Hello.
Nice to have you on the episode.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here. So I'll introduce myself and a little bit about what I do.
Yeah, do so.
Great. So as you said, I'm a social scientist and an ethnographic researcher. I'm based in Philadelphia, and I study new technologies and how they mainstream into society. So my work, it helps companies, whether they're a startup or an industry giant, to understand how people engage with their products or services and how future iterations could be improved. And then in terms of how I got into VR and my passion for it, obviously it's a new technology. So I'm very excited about it because I feel like after the iPhone and all of that, the touch screen technology came out, I think that this is the most revolutionary innovation to come our way. And I think that virtual reality or mixed reality, as I think it will all soon become, my passion comes from two places with regard to the innovation. The first is empathy, and the second is diffusion. And I feel that virtual reality offers us unprecedented levels of empathy, whether you know we try to embody a different race or gender or age group and really feel what it's like to be that person, or we sit and have dinner with a family of refugees, like I actually did in my first VR experience. Our minds and our bodies are counting that as real life experience. And those are things that I never could have done otherwise. And in my research, I've got a heavy anthropological bend because I believe that we need to approach people in their natural environment that they're using, whatever the technology I'm studying is. So in VR, for example, I haven't yet done this, but I'd love to do this. If I'm studying Vive use, I wouldn't do that in a usability lab or a focus group. I would go to people's living rooms and their basements and parties, wherever it is that they're using this, and observe what they're doing. So, you know, looking at things like environment, the social interaction, the space they're in, and other properties of the setting, and how that affects use. And then I take that back to the Vive dev team so they can design for things like room scale and other contextual issues.
This is really outstanding.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
How would you describe to our listeners the shift from information to experience age? So what is happening in general? What's the role of social media in it, for example?
Yeah. Well, as a global society, I think we've pretty much hit a wall a long time ago with our feelings about connection. And, you know, in a given day, we all spend hours checking various fragmented social and other media. And we can even, you know, get to feeling behind when we go a day or two or more without connecting. We feel lost. And yet, I think so many of us still wonder what this kind of connection means, if anything at all. Is it real connection? Is it meaningful? And we kind of go around feeling half connected to so many sources instead of fully connected to any one source. And that creates some problems in the way that we relate to each other. And, you know, we've seen other resources like Reddit, for example, try to aggregate and kind of curate the content that we want. But I don't think it's totally succeeding because we're still feeling so inundated with this sort of text-laden informational feed like Twitter and Facebook. And so we've tried to address this a little bit by, you know, integrating multimedia like videos and comments and posting and that sort of thing. And that got us to a different level. But I think soon we fell back into lacking that genuine connection. And what VR does is it's the next wave of connectedness. So now that we can be immersed in a news story or a game or a movie or attend an event on social VR like Altspace, we're really starting to change our language to talk about experiences instead of like news feed information that's coming at us. We're more participatory now in the technology. And I think this has huge effects on our social consciousness and also on the debate about whether we're alone or are we together in virtual and mixed reality.
Yeah, so you mentioned mixed reality. What is mixed reality? Because a lot of people usually would distinguish between augmented reality and virtual reality. But as it seems for you, it's kind of intermingling with each other.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is. I mean, I think it won't be long before we probably all use the term mixed reality. So for me, it just means that virtual environments, and even within that, there's still debate, right? So some people don't consider, for example, 360-degree video virtual reality because it's real. It's real scenes and it's real cinematic photography and such. But it is virtual in the sense that it still tricks your mind and your body to believing that you have that presence and that you're there. So it's an immersion that you couldn't have in another way. So it is virtually taking you somewhere else, even though the scenes are real. But in terms of mixed reality, what I include in that definition is 360-degree video, computer-generated environments, and also augmented reality, where things are overlaid, like in Magic Leap or with HoloLens. You know, we're starting to see even on social media, like Snapchat, for example, has just added augmented reality features. And even though a lot of people don't know who are using Snapchat, they might not even know that's what this is. They, you know, call them filters or overlays or whatever they call them, but really it's augmented reality. So these are ways that we're starting to mix these media together. And I think it's going to happen a lot in education and entertainment where, like I said before, we're going to be, the audience is going to have to be considered when people design for social media and for entertainment and other environments now, because we're in it. We're not just observing it.
Yes. How do you see the current Pokemon Go trend in this whole?
I love Pokemon Go. Well, I love it.
Are you playing it yourself?
Yeah, of course I'm playing. I was just playing it before I got on here.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I really like it. So I think it's kind of funny because to me, it reminds me of my immediate thoughts of Pokemon Go is like, you know, I think we're going to have to really, it's a perfect example, by the way, of the experience age, right? So instead of us walking around being glued to our phones and scrolling through Twitter feeds or posting Facebook responses or whatever, now we're looking at our phones and we're actually interacting. And it does, it does blind you to the world around you. So I think that my immediate fear with Pokemon Go, even though I love it, is regulation and what do we need to do to, you know, keep people safe and keep people aware of their environments. But it's definitely a great mixed reality forum.
Yeah. Now, when we speak about the adoption curve and about the regular users, it's pretty clear that the topics we are usually discussing here, like industrial usage of VR or scientific usage of VR, and not something for the everyday person. But if we speak about Snapchat or Pokemon Go or the Cardboard or the Gear VR, then it seems like it's really hitting the masses. So how does early adoption curve of VR influence the shift from the information to experience age?
Yeah, I think what you just pointed out is really important. The reason why it's very difficult, actually, and to me fascinating because I studied diffusion and I can talk briefly about that, but you know, the model that I use to study any new technology is diffusion of innovations. And it's just what you said, it's the adoption curve. So it's trying to help companies, for example, predict when, how fast, and why people would adopt a certain technology. And with VR, I feel that it's definitely the most fascinating diffusion journey that we've come across because it's really a moving target. It's not clear yet because of what you just said. You know, some people are using things on a daily basis and may not even realize that it's a type of virtual, augmented, or mixed reality. So it's not like they're using it and saying I like augmented reality because I use Pokemon Go. I mean, they're not. We don't even have enough knowledge about the medium as a general public, as a global public, to really even label the things correctly. So it's very difficult to, you know, in the past it was let's just use the iPhone again for simplicity, when it was diffusing, it was either, did you get the iPhone or did you not get the iPhone? There was no mystery about what is exactly the iPhone and in what way did you get it or not get it? It was black and white.
Yeah.
With VR, it's not that at all. I write a lot about the diffusion process being very difficult with this technology because there are several reasons, but two of the main ones are because within virtual reality, there's rapid simultaneous content creation going on all the time. So it doesn't leave any room for us to talk about VR in our social networks and decide, do we like it? Do we want more or not? And then businesses and industry and investors have a hard time in turn saying, well, we can't tell what the public thinks. Do they like it? Do they want it? How much are they going to use it? Should we invest in it? So what's happening is industry giants actually just took the dive before the public and said, we're going to do this. So you have, you know, Disney backing John or buying John, and you've got Facebook, you know, and all of these huge New York Times investing and saying, yes, this is going to be the future. While at the same time, to allude to your previous comment, you have people who are saying, oh, you know, I tried my cardboard and I didn't think it was anything great. Or worse yet, you know, 50%+ of the population gets cyber sickness. So those people who start off with, you know, their first few VR experiences being poor ones or getting sick and nauseated, then they go and talk about that with their friends and say, you know, I don't know if I'm going to try it again. So you've got all these very different conflicting influences, some that push adoption toward the tipping point and some that take away from that. So it's really hard to tell.
Okay. So after this short introduction to the shift from information to experience age, we discovered that one of the important features that we bring here to the table is empathy.
Yes.
Because it's the empathy that creates the experience, so to say, or that a lot of experiences, especially for masses, are about the empathy. So could you tell us now from your experience, why is VR important for empathy?
And vice versa, why empathy is so important for VR experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. VR offers, I mean, right now, at least in our our development, biologically, we can't yet tell the difference between a virtual experience, if it's done well and there's not a lot of latency, and a real experience. So our minds and our bodies, for all intents and purposes, have had a real life experience. So virtual reality is actually redefining what counts as real life. And that's huge. So if we have the opportunity, if we think about a virtual experience where we can be with another culture, or we think about embodiment. So, you know, you can see what it's like to be another race for a day. You can see what it's like to be a woman who's trying to get a job. You can see what it's like to be an elderly person and walk around a busy city street where people don't treat you very nicely. Whatever, you know, those things are, we couldn't do that in a safe environment, and we couldn't have those real experiences before virtual reality. And you know, I think that the level of immersion and the fact that so far we're not desensitized, where we still think we come away with a real and lived experience from these virtual reality experiences, is something that we've not had before as a human race, really. And I think about, particularly here in the U.S. and being in the fifth largest city in Philadelphia, we've had so much civil unrest, and, you know, the rise of gun culture here has created a really horrifying sort of normal, right? Where we wake up every week, or sometimes even each day, to a new story of like mass murder or police violence, or it's city protests with violence.
Yeah.
And we've really struggled with this relationship of authority and civilians for a long time. And I think about applications of VR there with empathy, like if police could experience the daily life of an African-American kid in a poor community and what it's like to feel in danger of being arrested or assaulted in a safe VR experience, it would really be just mind-blowing as a training or teaching tool.
So from the design perspective and the story and
creating the experience. How would you implement the embodied experience here? So, for example, you just said that it would be nice for a policeman to put himself in the shoes of another person.
Or vice versa.
Yes.
Actually, for the little black boy or girl to put himself in the position of the police guy who has the cover. So it's like vice versa, looking from the perspective of each other into each other.
Absolutely. I think that's very key. You know, so when you reverse that situation, you could see how a police officer is trained and may think if someone's, they may not know if someone's reaching in the backseat of a car, are they reaching for their wallet to show the police ID or are they reaching for a gun? And how fast do you act? You know, what are these different situations? And you could almost do it in a gaming environment too, where you could have agency, right? So you could have some that if it turns out that you as the police officer made a mistake and the person was reaching for their wallet and you took action, you could feel how that turned out. And yes, absolutely, for a child to understand, or even a you know, any civilian really, to understand that authority is trying to do a job and they have certain cues they're mm-hmm. looking for to react or not react, and how quickly they have to do that to get some empathy for them as well.
From the perspective of the agency, how would you design such an experience? So would you try out to have a third-person camera, so to say, or the third-person view and just see a 360 movie with a certain situation? Or would it be more interesting to have a first-person perspective but still a movie? Or maybe actually create a game where you are a first-person perspective and you are the one that makes decisions?
I like all of those. I mean, I'm not a designer, but I think from the empathy perspective, all of those matter, because, you know, the most important thing from a design perspective and an empathy perspective would be that you get, as Peter said, that you get both, right? So you give both parties the opportunity to jump into the other. So you would not only use it for mm-hmm. police training, but you would use it for citizens to understand what it's like to be in authority and have to make mm-hmm. quick decisions that sometimes result in not violence, but, you know, violence, actually. So I don't know how you would. I feel like they're all interesting ways to do it. There's not one way, but just make sure that both parties mm-hmm. get the experience.
Okay. In the early days of virtual reality, or modern virtual reality, there was an interesting concept for a movie where the same scene was recorded from the perspective of six people. So there was a 360 video made with the camera on six actors. So the scene was shot six times, so to say. And then when you were watching this movie, you could see a full movie just from the one person's perspective. And then often six people were invited to the room to watch it in the same time. And then they were exchanging experiences or their experience, yes, and what they saw in this movie. So then there was often a situation when people very energetically discussed, for example, that the mother in this scene was drunk. But from the mother's perspective, the son was tipsy and very angry, and he was just very negatively attituded towards the mother. Have you seen any more content in this direction?
Where they're using a VR experience to start a debate or to debate the content?
For example, so have you seen situations where there are people watching a video together and then discussing it afterwards?
Oh, I see. I have not seen that. I love that as also a teaching tool. I could see that being really important with, you know, there's a big movement in U.S., probably global education, actually, but I know that in the U.S., there are lots of programs for what's called social emotional learning. And that's, you know, schools are starting to pay attention to and teach skills in how we communicate with other people of different cultures, different races, different genders, et cetera, different knowledge levels, different, you know, maybe they've got disabilities of some sort. And I could see teachers implementing those kind of settings where, you know, you show something and you've got these different perspectives, and then you allow people to each give their interpretation of what they thought was happening. And then that alone can start so much understanding.
That's clear. I mean, for anyone who is not completely against VR, I think the most important point where they would all agree is that education and VR fit very nicely together. So, I mean, anyone who is at least a little bit educated of what VR can actually do will most certainly admit that if being used right, it can boost the motivation and also the education level of children. However, the question is, would something like an avatar help the children in the video or in the experience they perceive to boost the empathy and how they have the agency and interaction with the world? Or would you do it differently? So how would you do such an experience? Is it like really case specific, or are there certain, let's say, key features to an empathic experience, empathic VR experience, or like an embodied VR experience, an agency experience in VR?
Yeah, I gotcha. I think that to drive empathy, and this is why you see a lot of, well, let me finish the sentence. So to drive empathy, I do think that real scenes are probably much better at this point anyway than avatars. I mean, there is a lot of progress being made in avatar development, especially Altspace is going to get those to be pretty sophisticated after they work out some of their program or, you know, sort of platform issues and get those better, which are already great. But, you know, I know that they're working on, for instance, nonverbal cues and, you know, raising eyebrows or, you know, making a character have better gestural movement and flow like a real person would. So I think that that will change. But I think right now, in order to create an empathic experience, I think the scenes should be real. The people should be real. You know, 360 video is very good at that. And that's why you see organizations like, you know, animal rights, human rights organizations using VR as a vehicle to drive empathy.
I actually disagree here for the reason that for me, a very important feature of virtual reality, something that new virtual reality actually lets you to do in a very easy way, is agency. So by agency, I mean that you can move yourself, that you at least see the controllers in the game. And that's just a very simple level. But even in the 360 movies, it's a matter of how much influence you as a viewer have on the story. That means that, for example, you could use the gaze triggers, so to say, so that you have a 360 video and at some point the video stops and then you can choose the next decision point so that you yourself can decide that this policeman, let's say, shoots a warning shot or speaks calmly again. And then on the other hand, there is another point of agency, so how you as a camera are pictured in the story, so to say. So I have seen two types of 360 videos where there is just a 360 camera and something happens. There is a story around the camera and you can look around, so a very passive story. And on the other hand, there were other videos where the camera was an integral part of the story. So for example, an early 360 content was called Teleporter or something like that, where three people found something in the middle of the room and started to touch it. And then you as a camera were teleporting other people somewhere, just as an example of camera being a part of a story. Now, coming back to empathy, for me, that would be far more interesting and far more engaging to stay for longer than 3 or 4 minutes in the movie if I would have some influence on the story on the one hand, and on the other hand, when I would be part of the story. So in this particular example, let's take refugees, where the camera, so to say, the boring solution for me would be where the when the camera stands in the middle of the table and nobody cares about this camera. But the cool, easy solution could be that the camera stands on one of the chairs and then people are talking to you, like you are part of the family that you're sitting with at the table.
There is also a certain usage of virtual reality and empathy in the journalism, right? So, I mean, if you're speaking about a refugee family or a certain events you want to show, yes, there's a certain education to it, as usual, but you could also bring people a little bit closer to what's happening. And I think there's also a great TED Talk, actually, about it from, I hope I don't pronounce the name wrong, Noni Della Pena. It's called The Future. Yeah, it's really good. It's called The Future of the New. So we put it in the show notes. And she's speaking there about different experiences that are also meant for virtual reality journalism. yet the empathy part is playing there a big role. Like someone is breaking in front of you and you're having like some kind of wife on your head, wife, and you're running around with it, and you can actually see how someone is having a diabetic attack, and you kind of can interact and try to help him. Like that triggers people to really have a mental breakdown sometimes, because it's, you know, such a strong feeling. But if you're speaking about all those effects, let's maybe go over to the topic of how VR could change the social consciousness. Like what would you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of those applications are useful, and they all certainly provide empathy, and agency is really important. So yes, I don't disagree that, you know, having agency helps you also to figure out, and helps me actually as a researcher. It's part of the models that I'm trying to set up for measuring empathy and action with VRs, because, you know, it, you can always ask someone to watch, say, a 2D video of a refugee camp and then watch a 3D video or a VR experience of the same content and see which provides more empathy, or which triggers more empathy, rather. That's one way. But until you give someone agency and allow them to act on, you know, how they would be in that situation, you really don't know if VR creates any different behavior or not. So I think that's really what we want to know, isn't it? I mean, we can guess that empathy will increase, but so what if it doesn't change behavior? Yeah. So anyway, I think in terms of social consciousness, that's what my hope is, that, you know, there are many, you can see many applications for VR that would not be very positive and could be very evil. And VR has the ability to create a lot of trauma and, you know, psychological effects that could be long lasting. But on the positive end, if we think about social consciousness and what it allows us to do, I think that there's going to be a big debate about, just as there is now, about the value of social media and how we spend our time, and is it really social or isn't it? I think VR will have that same debate heightened, for people to say, you know, does it bring us together or does it divide us? And I believe in the good aspects of it, that it brings us together, because I could never have, unless I went voluntarily to take a vacation or to take a, you know, a trip, like I would have to travel to a refugee camp where, you know, I had that same sort of really deep, deeply empathic experience of the Syrian refugees, the family that I had, most people would never do that in their lifetime. So I think it brings together, you know, issues of culture, issues of understanding, and things that we could never get to otherwise. And that is a collective sort of feeling that should bring us to feel that we're all the same. We're all more the same than we are different.
Well, okay. I mean, I could also play the, you know, devil's advocate role and say that, well, yes, this is a very nice, bright future that might be true, that, you know, virtual reality will bring everyone together. But I see personally a huge debate coming up that VR and also maybe mixed reality might divide or isolate us. And because it will be so strongly potentially replacing traditional media or not, or maybe just enhancing them, a lot of people will be, you know, very afraid of the new technologies, like with the Tesla those days. There is one person who died in an accident and everyone around the world is discussing how dangerous Teslas are. And I guarantee that the first moment someone who is mentally ill is playing all day VR and then goes and does, you know, some terrible things like shooting at someone, right? Everyone will blame VR. Like every time there is someone in Germany, for example, and I think in the US it's similar, that does a homicide and he played some kind of, you know, Call of Duty games where you have to shoot. Everyone is blaming the games. No one is blaming his mental condition or his environment or him being bullied. It's usually the easy target. And I think with VR it might happen that those people that are, let's say, prone to being rather alone, right? I mean, there are a certain part of the population that kind of likes to be less social. They don't have such a strong attitude. And some people are even afraid of social contacts. And those people will tend to overuse VR, maybe from the perspective of some other people, because they will just feel better there. For example, autistic children love internet because at every point they can just shut it down. Because, you know, they can't do this in a real conversation, just can't run away. But in the internet, you can always just close the window. And VR might be the next step for especially those people. But the problem is that the general, let's say, audience doesn't understand those correlations among those issues. And we'll see that some people will just completely immerse and dissolve in VR and will be, you know, super negative towards it. Do you see that, or do you think that the main players influencing the social consciousness would be rather good and also viewed by the, you know, major common narrative as something good?
I think VR is going to, I mean, this is going to sound a little bit revolutionary, but I think that VR is going to be a big player in what happens next with our global culture. And it's going to, you know, we're kind of at a bubbling up point right now where, you know, there's so much unrest the world over, and we don't know if we should turn toward each other or away from each other. I mean, Brexit, you know, here in the US, we're talking about Texas being its own, you know, country and building walls and all these crazy things. And it's, you know, there will always be people on either side of that debate. And there will always be people who practice on the good or the evil side, always. You know, it's going to be in the way that the reason I take it as a positive and mostly a force of good is because of what I see in the community, in the VR community. Compared with any other technology I've studied in the past 16 years, and the way that it's diffused and become convention, VR is completely different in terms of its community. It's very collaborative. It's quite wide open. It's very open source, democratized, sharing, all those things.
Yes, but don't you think that if we look at the history of the internet at the beginning was also very open democracy and everyone was collaborative, and then came the Secret Service agencies and some people who wanted to earn dirty money with it, writing viruses, and suddenly the internet also became a threat. Like, sure, the internet in the 80s and 90s was developed by scientists who were connecting universities among each other and sending each other nice letters, but then somehow the normal users hit it, and when the normal users hit it, also the mass effect starts to happen that people try to misuse it for certain evil things, right?
Do you think it's coming? Oh, absolutely. There's no question. I'm sure it's happening now, sadly.
No.
But yeah, I mean, you know that when something becomes available, people will avail themselves in whatever capacity they choose. And it will be, you know, I choose not to think of the really scary possibilities that virtual worlds and augmented worlds could lead us to. You know, you think of trauma or torture, or, you know, any of these psychological things that could happen, much less privacy with augmented reality and security. You know, all of those things are on the table. They're on the table with drones now. They're on the table with the internet now. I think you have to, what I hold on to is that the community right now is not protected. It's not guarded. It feels very, you know, I think we realize as people involved in this industry, I think we realize that it is so influential and it is so important that we treat it in the kindness, greater good way, that we're coming at it that way. And all of the other things will come. Regulation will come. Privacy issues will come. Evil will come. All those things will happen. But we hope, just with, you know, as we do with every other advance, that that the humanistic side of this prevails.
Mm-hmm. Going one step back to our discussion about the social consciousness, from your experience with other technologies too, what would be the methods to measure the effects of virtual reality on social consciousness changes?
You want me to give away my secrets? Kidding.
Not all.
Well, you could just give us some keywords.
I'm just
kidding. You know, breadcrumbs.
Yeah, just trigger so people will come to you for more expertise.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think that what the scenario that you laid out before, where if you've got an experience that's, say, 360 versus an agency-driven experience, I think those would be remarkable in order to show the impact, and does VR lead to different, not just thoughts, but actions. So I think that's something that could help to measure and, quote, you know, have some evidence or proof that VR does this. Where I'm headed is, I have a lot of questions about long-term behavior. And, you know, so these experiences we have, as we start to become a more experience age culture, global culture, will we become desensitized in any measure to, you know, the empathy or the actions that we might take. I mean, you know, at some point, is it going to just become normal to have these experiences and then be able to say in our minds, oh, but that wasn't real? And that could happen. So I don't, you know, there are a lot of I don't knows. And I love this community because the I don't knows are very, very common. It's okay to say, I don't know. And people will echo that and say, I don't know either. but, you know, we're trying to figure out how to measure this. And I'm very much interested in moving past just looking at empathy, because I do think that's important. Of course, it's a huge part of my research. But I would also like to look at measuring action and different behaviors as a result of VR and that immersion level.
Interesting.
So I would maybe propose that we all give a last statement regards the future of VR.
And then actually, I have one more question. Okay, from your perspective and your experience with 360 video content and content with the goal to change the empathy level, how would you convince more people to watch it? So, for example, I am a very skeptical person, first of all, to 360 videos, and second of all, to empathetic content. So, for example, I personally did not watch yet, shame on me, any of the refugees 360 videos.
Okay.
So how would you convince me to watch such a video when I'm in my own daily bubble of information and work and my own tasks?
Yeah, I think it's going to be up to... So this is where, you know, you have to hold a lot of hope in your hands too, because it's going to be up to the people that move our world. It's going to be up to news industries, entertainment industries, the people who have money and ability to create sophisticated content that can, it doesn't all have to be sophisticated to be empathic or to get you to feel something or do something. It doesn't. But in order to get you to have that content be presented to you enough that you almost have no choice but to see it, right? So if it's presented to you in news, in you know, journalistic VR, if it's presented to you via Facebook and your social platforms, you know, soon enough, those kind of laggards that at the tail end of the diffusion curve who really don't want to consume content, certain types of content, right, touchy-feely or empathic content in VR, they don't want to be immersed in that. I think that they will probably have to be to some extent. I don't think VR will ever replace the current media choices that we have, but I think it will be a big player. And, you know, if it's driven by the huge forces that drive human culture, I think at some point you will find yourself consuming that kind of media.
You're doing a lot of user experience research, at least connected with the user experience research. So how do you see, or what do you think about the way that Facebook delivers you now 360 pictures? So what they do is you can watch a 360 picture or video in your Gear VR, but that means that you need to open your Facebook, choose a picture, put it in a Gear VR and watch it, or watch it directly from Gear VR. But when you watch it directly from Gear VR, you don't have access to your feed from Facebook.
Yeah, I think that'll probably be worked out via some sort of, I don't know what it'll be, a universal operating system, something that's going to make it accessible that either erases the equipment or makes the equipment smaller and more accessible. One of the two things that's going to have to happen pretty soon, because again, as far as diffusion and mainstreaming this kind of technology, I think the physical hardware that we use is one obstacle. I don't think big head mounted devices are going to be around for very long at all. And it's the reason why, actually one reason why I haven't invested in a Vive myself. So I feel like those things are very scary, and they contribute to that feeling of isolation because you're literally blinding yourself to the world around you. So how could you not make an argument that in some ways you're isolating yourself? So I think that those options of, you know, how do you access VR even with something as powerful as Facebook being behind that social platform, I think that people are working probably voraciously right now as we speak on how to make it more accessible with less gear and across different platforms.
Yeah, that's most certainly sure. However, if we
think about the potential of VR to actually, let's say, kill or maybe replace the traditional media. There are a few examples in the history, like television killed the radio star, you know how you say it, or like the newspapers are slowly dying out because people just switched to digital. I would be a little bit more skeptical regards the potential of something like a television show or something like a newspaper or something like radio being still there in maybe 20 years the same way we know it right now. So, I mean, it definitely will change it. And I think that if that what you described, the technology that you just put on your head that are just, you know, light sunglasses that have already virtual reality inbuilt in them or something like that, that is not like shutting yourself out from the world, but actually augmenting it or mixing it with reality, like really the bright future, then I have a feeling that most of the traditional media will be just not needed anymore. So at least that's my view on that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to some extent, I agree that what will happen is, I guess you could use the word enhancement, right? Or complementary. I mean, I feel like TV as we know it now is really on the brink. I think it's been on the brink of extinction for so long. It's just strange to sit in front of this box and just sit and not be interactive, be totally passive. It's a weird thing in this day and age. But, you know, if you think of maybe the podcast, you know, what we're doing right now, I mean, some people might have thought, well, what's going to happen to radio with podcasts? I mean, why wouldn't you just want to listen to the content you want and the stations you want and, you know, have your Spotify, Pandora and your podcasts and you're good to go? Yet there are still complementary features of radio, NPR, World Yes. Radio, things that, you know, mm-hmm. haven't gone away.
And traffic news.
Yes, that's important. But, you know, yeah, these
like
things.
People listen mostly to radio actually in cars. So it's really listening to nice music, to someone talking, and also having traffic news. And obviously the outstanding content like BBC. I mean, you don't listen to BBC because you want to listen to radio or like to the NPR or the other really great stations, but because they are just great. I mean, that's like with you of the magazines out there. You read them because they are just outstandingly great. But the waste amount of, you know, journals that used to be there or newspapers just having a huge decline, like radio listeners too, because people are switching to those Pandora things.
Right, right. Well, and again, it's sort of, you know, do you consider that the next generation of radio? Like I do. I mean, I don't consider it a killing of radio. It has shifted the platform of what radio looks yeah. like, but it's still, the roots are still radio to me. So I guess it's relative.
Okay. Then let's maybe come to an end. How can people reach out to you? Like if they would, you know, have questions, do you have a Twitter account?
Yes, I do. I'm Julie Kroner and that's Twitter. I'm mostly, the quickest way to get me is through my website, which is juliekroner.com. And I do some writing there in my blog called The Raconteur. And I love when people, you know,
You're
respond there if they read something they like or, you know, write me through there. I'm very quick to respond. And I think that's probably the quickest way to get me is juliekroner.com.
You also have a Medium account, right?
I do. Yes.
You have also great articles there, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. And I'm going to continue writing as VR takes hold in different verticals. I'm writing my next piece on VR and education. But as each vertical kind of establishes itself with VR, I will be writing about that.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Research VR. Hope you enjoyed listening to it and learned something new. As usual, topic suggestion, guest invites, and all other feedback are very helpful. Feel free to contact us under researchvrcast@gmail.com or via Twitter, where you can find us at the handle @researchvrcast. Rate us, please, on iTunes and help spread the podcast away. You can subscribe to it in any way you want. We are everywhere. We are RSS feed, SoundCloud, and so on. Check our website, researchvr.podigy.io. And a special thanks to Nelson Balabanian for the intro and outro music. Find him at SoundCloud/nurses-balabanian. Thank you very much.